What did I do on that Spanish?
Oh, that would be...
Mr. Bernard, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. On the 7th day of November of 1981, Denver Detective Sergeant Don DeNovelis obtained information from a confidential informant. The informant told Detective DeNovelis that a person known as Antonio Guadalupe Nunez had been seen by the informant within the last 24 hours preparing heroin for sale. He was diluting the heroin and putting it into balloons, a common mode of packaging for sale. The informant told Detective DeNovelis that Mr. Nunez said that he had recently been to Mexico, and in Mexico he had purchased 5 ounces of heroin. Detective DeNovelis then obtained a search warrant based upon this information, and along with Adams County Sheriff's officers, went to Mr. Nunez's home in Adams County, Colorado. They entered the home and searched Mr. Nunez, and from his pocket they took 15 balloons which contained heroin. Mr. Nunez was charged with possession of a Schedule I controlled substance in Colorado, and his counsel filed a motion to suppress the fruits of that search, alleging in part there was no probable cause for that search. He also filed a motion for the disclosure of this particular confidential informant who provided this information. A hearing was held in September of 1982 upon that motion for disclosure. At that time, Mr. Nunez himself testified. He stated, among other things, that he was off in the mountains hunting in his motorhome, that he had not been to Mexico, and that the only people who had been at his home within 24 hours of the 7th day of November of 1981 were members of his immediate and extended family. He also said at one point during cross-examination that he did not know what heroin was. The court, based upon this information, ordered the prosecution to disclose the name of the informant.
Mr. Bernard, do you think that the Colorado court based its holding on federal law?
I certainly do, Justice O'Connor, and for the following reasons. The court in the case of Colorado versus Nunez relied upon 3 prior Colorado decisions. The first decision was People versus Daly, which had been decided approximately 1.5 years before. In People versus Daly, the Colorado Supreme Court referred at one point to the Colorado Constitution, but at that time it was only for the amount of information necessary to begin a veracity hearing.
Well, on that point, I think Daly states that in Colorado the rule is that a defendant is entitled to a veracity hearing once he shows a good faith basis for believing the material in the affidavit was inaccurate. Now, do you think that holding is based on federal law?
Your Honor, I would like to say so, but I don't believe that I can, because there's an indication clearly that it was based upon the Colorado Constitution. But the issue in this case concerns the disclosure of the informant. The Colorado court in Daly...
The Roviaro-McRae issue?
That is correct.
On that, do you think the Colorado law is the same as or based on federal law?
Yes.
On that aspect of the question?
Yes. Justice Lohr said exactly that. They have adopted the same test as Roviaro versus McRae. If I may elaborate on my answer a little bit. In the Daly opinion, the Colorado Supreme Court said specifically that while the Colorado Constitution may support a lesser amount of evidence showing, when it talked about what consequences, and disclosure is one of the consequences, that must flow from the decision the court must make after that showing, it referred specifically to both the United States Constitution and to the Colorado Constitution. At that hearing, after that hearing and after the order of disclosure, the prosecution took an interlocutory appeal to the Supreme Court of the state of Colorado, in which that issue was addressed. The Colorado Supreme Court affirmed the lower court's decision, and we petitioned for certiorari. This court granted review. The issue in this case is essentially twofold.
Excuse me, in Colorado, is it true that you could have had an in-camera hearing on this point?
That is correct, Justice Marshall.
And you didn't ask for it?
No, we did not. We did
Why?
Not. We were concerned for the informant's safety. We
In an in-camera?
Yes, Your Honor. The first issue in this case is an issue that was reserved in Franks versus Delaware. In that opinion, at page 170, Justice Blackmun reserved the issue, a difficult issue, of whether an informant should be disclosed after a satisfactory showing at a veracity hearing. The issue in this case also concerns where, as in the case at bar, if the counsel for the accused and the court both concede that the credibility of the police officer affiant is not an issue, therefore, should there be disclosure at all? Before we
Do you
get
think the federal constitution imposes some limits on how liberal a state's rule of evidence can be on that point?
Your Honor, I believe that this goes to a question of Fourth Amendment interpretation and the exclusionary rule. First of all, beginning with Aguilar's and Spinelli and with this Court's recent decision in Illinois versus Gates, there is clearly an issue of whether a confidential informant can be used in a search warrant. When that happens, that becomes a Fourth Amendment issue. This is not merely a question of evidentiary law, but this is a question of the application of the Fourth Amendment. The question is, therefore, does the Fourth Amendment require disclosure if, after a veracity hearing, there is a certain showing?
Do you think the Fourth Amendment forbids the disclosure of an informant's name?
Yes. We submit that the Fourth Amendment does that. And we submit, even assuming in certain situations that the Fourth Amendment does permit disclosure of an informant's name after an appropriate showing at a veracity hearing, in our case, that should not be, because the whole purpose of a veracity hearing is to question whether the state itself has erred in any way, whether there's been police misconduct. If the affiant's credibility is not at issue, in other words, if the affiant in good faith relied upon what he was told by his informant, then there is no purpose, no application, no deterrent result for the exclusionary rule.
When you get to the veracity, if you don't admit who the person is, if you don't have an in-camera investigation, you use the word veracity. That means truth, doesn't it? Well, how do you get to the truth if you hide the truth?
Well, Justice Marshall, first of all, I do not believe that the purpose of using confidential informants is to hide the truth. I think this Court has recognized what their use is in the past. The issue at a veracity hearing...
What remedy does the defense counsel have if the government says, we have this information, but we won't tell you where we got it from?
First, the defense counsel could strenuously cross-examine the affiant himself. The affiant was present and available.
Who I assume is also very capable.
Pardon me?
He's very capable. He's not a run-of-the-mill person.
The affiant?
The officer, yeah.
I would hope that the officer is capable.
He's a well-trained person.
Yes, sir.
So if you can't break him down, then you lose.
Not necessarily, Your Honor.
What else can you do?
There are alternative forms of information. For example, as in this case, information from the accused himself, information from other people whom the accused may bring into the court, who have information to give to the court on this issue. Hypothetically, if the assertion had been that I had not been at my home when that person was the affiant, and one is permitting the defense himself to bring in information to attack the credibility of the affiant.
Well, why can't you have the in-camera hearing?
An in-camera hearing...
Is there somebody in there that you don't trust?
No.
Because if you say so, I'm going to ask you to name him.
No.
Well, why can't you have an in-camera hearing?
Because an in-camera hearing, we feel, has certain threats. One threat is this. If an informant knows that he is going to be brought before a court, even in camera without defense counsel present, he may not provide the police the information that is necessary to either solve a crime or to...
If I assume that correct, and I also assume that on the same facts, an informant could not hesitate to lie because he knows nothing could be done about it?
Justice Marshall, I submit that there is always the possibility that an informant may lie, and I think that that's undeniable. There's always the possibility that a police officer may lie. But I don't think that the presumption is either that police officers or informants lie. I think that the privilege itself was established to permit a flow of information. And I think in the case of McRae versus Illinois, Justice Weintraub foresaw exactly the problem that we see in this case. In the quote that I have cited in my brief, Justice Weintraub says that if a defendant knows that he can submit to the court any evidence at all, the court itself is going to order disclosure because they have no ability to impeach. At that point, the informant will always be disclosed, and the whole chain of information will be broken, the flow of information will be dried up. If at a veracity hearing, the purpose is to determine whether there is probable cause to believe that the accused has committed a crime and probable cause to believe that at his residence are the fruits of that crime, then in this case, the disclosure of the informant is an ancillary part of that. It's part of the probable cause determination. Since Aguilar and Spinelli and Gates made rules under our Constitution to govern the use of confidential informers in warrants, the decision whether to disclose them becomes a Fourth Amendment consideration here. As I said to Justice O'Connor earlier, it's not a question of evidentiary law, state evidentiary law. It's part and parcel of the Franks versus Delaware analysis, and it is part and parcel of the issue that this court reserved in that case. There is an issue as to whether there was an independent and adequate state grounds for this decision, which Justice O'Connor raised. The tests that this court has established in a series of cases, Delaware versus Prowse, South Dakota versus Neville, culminating with Michigan versus Long, which was decided in July of 1983, I believe, indicates that this court presumes that there is not an independent and adequate state grounds if there is not a clear and express showing on the face of the opinion. In this case, as far as the issue of disclosure is concerned, there was no clear and independent showing of state law. As far as any remedy to be derived from a veracity hearing, there was no clear and independent showing of state law. Based upon that presumption, I submit that this court does and should take jurisdiction. In the Colorado Supreme Court's decision in the Nunez case, it referred, as I said earlier, to three cases: the case of Daly, the case of Martinez, and the case of Bueno. In Daly, when the court talked about disclosure, it referred to two things. First, Franks versus Delaware, which was a case decided by this court on Fourth Amendment grounds. And then the court talked about, solely in Daly, if there is the affiant's perjury or reckless disregard for the truth, the Colorado court discussed that remedy in terms of Franks only. In other words, in terms only of the Colorado Constitution. In terms of the United States Constitution. I apologize, Justice White, my mistake. In fact, that court said that the test for disclosure is the same that this court established in Roe v. Arrow and in McRae versus Illinois.
May I just ask one question about the disposition of the case? Your brief ends by saying the judgment should be reversed. Do you mean by that to say that the Colorado Supreme Court could not reinstate its prior judgment and explain that it really did mean to base it on Colorado law?
Justice Stevens, that's always a possibility. The Colorado Supreme Court could say this was a decision that should have been decided on Colorado state law. refer to the Colorado Constitution and decide it that way.
So they could, the outcome of the case could conceivably, we don't say it will, but conceivably could it be exactly the same no matter what we do?
I would submit that this is, that if this court reversed, the Colorado Supreme Court would be bound by this court's opinion. If in a later case the Colorado Supreme Court wished to adopt the Colorado Constitution, then it could do so.
But do you think we can tell them that they must hold a veracity hearing?
Well, they, I believe
that... I mean, they must direct the lower court to hold a veracity.
I believe so, especially since it referred to the United States Constitution. And since this court is the ultimate arbiter of that Constitution, I believe that this court can say that.
And they have lost their authority to reach the same conclusion based on state law.
I would submit that they have.
Well, Mr. Bernard, that's quite a remarkable conclusion, I think, that you reach an answer to Justice Stevens' question, that the I can see how we could say in a correct case that the Fourth Amendment doesn't require the sort of rule which the Colorado Supreme Court thought it required. But you're saying that even though the Colorado Supreme Court wished to base its ruling on state law, the Fourth Amendment prevents it from doing that.
No, I'm not saying that, Justice Rehnquist.
Well, then could you spell out exactly how you reached the conclusion that you do in answer to Justice Stevens' question?
Certainly. This court can decide the federal issue present in this case. If it does so, then the court must say that since the Colorado Supreme Court referred to the consequences under the United States Constitution, the Colorado Supreme Court cannot take the United States Constitution and do what it wanted to do in this case. If the Colorado Supreme Court wishes to rely on the state constitution, I concur it is the ultimate arbiter of that constitution.
Yes, and any mandate that comes down from this court to a state court says, reversing the state court opinion, says the judgment is reversed and the cause remanded for further proceedings not inconsistent with this opinion. Wouldn't such a proceeding be a hearing by the Colorado Supreme Court in which it said, well, we also relied on our state constitution, or although we didn't before, we now rely on our state constitution to reach the result we did?
Justice Rehnquist, I would submit that that certainly is a possibility. However, if in fact that were the case, I am not cognizant of the subsequent decisions in Michigan versus Long at the state level and South Dakota versus Neville at the state level.
That wouldn't take our jurisdiction away to hear the case, but I think that that would mean that your answer to Justice Stevens' question perhaps ought to be reconsidered.
Well, Justice Rehnquist, I guess what my position is this, that this court can tell the Colorado Constitution it can't do what it did under the United States Constitution. If it wishes to do that under the Colorado Constitution, I suppose that it can do so.
It's done that after we've reversed on the federal ground here?
Yes.
The Opperman case, I think, South Dakota?
Yes, and I know California has done that too.
Several of them have done that. That might lead some people to the conclusion that the court should not have been so ambiguous about the basis of its holding.
Well, ultimately, I think that that's probably an appropriate resolution anyway. If a court does decide that it is going to rely on state law, I think Michigan versus Long says if it's going to do that, it should make it very clear, and that's not been done in this case. Ultimately, there is no Fourth Amendment violation if an affiant, in good faith...
Well, this case was decided before we decided in Michigan along, didn't it?
Yes, by the Colorado court it was.
Well, whether did we ever say before Michigan and Long that the state Supreme Court had to say clearly whether or not it relied on the state court?
At the time that the Colorado case was decided, there was in existence the following cases, Delaware versus Prowse, South Dakota versus Neville, and those cases indicated that there is an appropriate basis for this court taking jurisdiction. If there may be an independent ground, but it's not adequate, and that was the prior test. In fact, in our petition for writ of certiorari in the jurisdictional statement at pages 1 through 9, we did argue those cases and not Michigan versus Long. I think even under those tests, there's an appropriate basis for this court to take jurisdiction, and there is not an independent and adequate state grounds.
But you do contend, don't you, that Michigan against Long announced a new rule of law?
Well,
Do you argue that rule is retroactive?
Your Honor, I'm not...
Or is that maybe that's the issue in the case, whether Michigan against Long is retroactive?
That's not the issue here, obviously.
I mean, it's a jurisdictional issue, I might suggest.
This court does have to decide whether it has jurisdiction. And we have not briefed whether Michigan versus Long is retroactive, nor...
But are you content to have us decide the jurisdictional issue without reference to Michigan against Long?
I prefer to have it because I think it's clearer.
I think it's a little helpful to you.
Yes, I do. Yeah. Yes, I do. The exclusionary rule, which was applied in this case because the evidence was suppressed when the state refused to disclose its informant, balances two social issues. First of all, the deterrence of police misconduct against convicting guilty people. There is no deterrence by the application of the exclusionary rule if there's no police misconduct. Therefore, if there is no deterrent effect, there's no need to let the guilty go free. The purpose of a veracity hearing, therefore, has to be to determine if the affiant, not the informant, has engaged in misconduct. There will be, I would submit, an effect on law enforcement in revealing the names of confidential informants on a regular basis. That will dry up sources of information which lead to the solving of crimes and dry up sources of information that lead to the apprehension of criminals. It is a sad but true fact that some people will not come forward and cooperate with the police unless they're assured of anonymity.
Health is a not.
It is, Your Honor. And that, sadly, has been something that has happened in the past. As we indicated before, we say that there is no need as a matter of law ever to reveal an informant's name, and I discussed with Justice Marshall the alternatives to disclosure of that informant. However, even if an informant should be revealed in some circumstances, he should not be revealed here. There was only private action in this case. Although there has been some indication by the respondent that the respondent didn't mean to say that he did not question the affiant's credibility, nonetheless, the record contains four separate references to the fact that he was concerned with the informant and not the affiant's credibility. Secondly, disclosure does not serve in this case because there was no police misconduct, the Fourth Amendment, or the purposes of the exclusionary rule. Even people who are involved at the fringes of warrant process are going to be affected by the fact that they will not be assured of anonymity. We ask this court to, at least as far as the Fourth Amendment is concerned, indicate to the state of Colorado that the disclosure of informants should not occur at veracity hearings. And even if this court feels that disclosure is in some cases appropriate, we ask this court to indicate that the disclosure of the informant in this case was inappropriate because there was no indication, no allegation, and no proof that the affiant lied or recklessly disregarded the truth.
Mr. Stern.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. The way this case has been postured, both in the briefs and during oral argument, is inconsistent with the record below. The petitioner has raised and melded together three separate issues, only one of which was ever adjudicated in the Colorado court system. In Colorado, the process of challenging a search warrant and making a veracity challenge has three separate steps. One step is making a threshold preliminary showing to be entitled to a hearing in the first place. The second step is actually being successful on the merits.
And what's the purpose of that veracity hearing, as you call it out there?
In Colorado?
What's the purpose of it, yes.
Well, the purpose of the veracity hearing at this point in time under Colorado law is to see if the affiant either committed perjury or reckless disregard of the truth. The Colorado Supreme...
Put that in concrete terms. What did the affiant say, the informant? What did he say that's going to be tested in this hearing?
One, does the informant either even exist? And two, if the informant does exist, did he actually relate to the affiant what the affiant placed in the affidavit?
Well, now that doesn't tell me much in concrete terms. What is it said that the informant informed to the police in this case?
In the affidavit, there is certain information allegedly stated by an informant.
What was it?
It was that on a certain date, that the informant was in the home of the defendant and observed the defendant engage in certain conduct.
And what was the conduct?
The conduct was packaging heroin.
And what happened when they made the search?
They did find heroin.
Does that have any bearing on whether he was telling the truth?
Obviously, it would have some bearing, Chief Justice. However, there are other possible sources of information that could have led to the conclusion that Mr. Nunez had heroin, which didn't come to an informant. In fact, a number of the commentators have stated that it's possible that information could have come through an illegal wiretap.
Now, let me see. I'm not sure I track you. You say the informant told the police that on a given day he was in the home of Nunez and that he saw him engaged in handling dope, packaging.
That's correct.
And then he gave that information to the police.
That's correct.
And then they put that in whatever form is required in Colorado law to get a warrant to search the house. Is that right?
Correct.
And then the police took that warrant and went and searched the house. Is that right?
Correct.
And then they found the packages exactly as the informant said they would. Is that right?
Very close to how he said they would be. That's correct.
What's the problem about his veracity then?
The problem is veracity is that the defendant testified that the informant could not have done what it was alleged that he had done in the affidavit. Because on those dates in question, the defendant had not been in his home. He was away for 2 weeks. He could not have been delivering heroin using his vehicle during those 2 weeks. He was not in his home when the informant said he was there. He was on a fishing trip. And that the only people who were there the second half of the day were his immediate relatives. So there was testimony from the defendant that created in the mind of the trial court judge a good faith basis in fact to question the accuracy of the affidavit. And under that particular test, under Colorado law,
What if the informant had said to the police that he had been in the home of this man on a day within recent weeks or months, and he could not remember the day or the week, but that he distinctly saw him putting narcotics in packages on that day, unnamed? Make it a little difficult for the a man to say he wasn't there at that time, then, wouldn't it?
Then that would create a different problem of proof.
Would it be sufficient to issue a warrant if the informant could not fix the date?
Well, that would be up to the magistrate to determine if that was sufficient to establish probable cause. However, in the instant case, you have an informant saying he was located in the house at a particular time when, based upon testimony under oath by the defendant and other collateral evidence, he could not, at least it created a reasonable basis in fact to believe that he could not have been in the house. And therefore, Colorado, under Colorado's common law, as an evidentiary matter, allows the informant to be disclosed, either in camera or to all the parties, so that the defendant can have a reasonable opportunity to make the showing that he must make at the veracity hearing itself.
Who was it who had to decide whether the defendant here was telling the truth when he said he was out on a fishing trip on that day?
The trial court judge.
Without a jury?
Without a jury.
And is that an in-camera proceeding in Colorado, or is it an open hearing?
Well, the first stage where the defendant must meet his burden of showing good faith basis in fact that the affidavit contains inaccuracies is an open hearing. If after hearing that, the trial court judge decides that the defendant has met his burden and therefore is entitled to either disclosure in camera or to all the parties, then they would proceed accordingly.
Mr. Stern, do you think that applying the standard and the balancing explained in the Roviaro opinion under the federal standard for when an informant's identity will be disclosed, that the disclosure would have been ordered in this case?
Applying that standard, I believe that it would have been.
There would have been disclosure.
There would have been disclosure.
Do you think the Colorado court applied that standard?
I do not.
As I was stating before, the issue regarding the preliminary threshold showing and the issue regarding what you must prove to be successful at the veracity hearing itself were never raised in this case. In fact, if you were to remand this case, the motion to suppress, which contained the veracity challenge, is still pending before the trial court. It was never decided. The only issue ever decided was disclosure of confidential informants. So therefore, if the case was reversed, we would pick up with that veracity challenge and go to hearing on it. Suppression was not issued pursuant to the Fourth Amendment. Suppression was issued as a discovery sanction. After the motion to disclose informant was decided, was heard, the trial court judge ordered disclosure. When the prosecution did not comply with that discovery order, the defense counsel filed a second motion to suppress. That second motion to suppress, which was ultimately granted, was based as a sanction for failure to comply with a discovery order.
Well, this chronology, it doesn't lead, I would think, to the necessary conclusion that there is not a federal basis for the Supreme Court of Colorado's decision. It's just that its decision is a narrower one than you say your opponents have painted.
My response is twofold. First, the only issue is the motion to disclose informant. Second, if you were to look at the four corners of the Nunez opinion, there is not one federal authority cited, not one federal case cited. It is only state cases.
Well, let me put this question. So, supposing that the district court in Adams County says, I'm going to order the disclosure of this informant pursuant to Roviaro, which I think is binding on us, the no suppression, but like in Hickman against Taylor, where suddenly someone has to go to jail in order to raise a question in an appellate court, the district attorney says, no, we won't disclose, but I'm going to appeal to the Supreme Court of Colorado. The Supreme Court of Colorado says, under Roviaro, this case, this informant should have been disclosed. I think that person can come here and say you've got a federal question, don't you?
Absolutely.
You just say that's not what happened
here. That's absolutely not what happened. Because, again, if you look at the four corners of the Nunez opinion, they don't mention a single federal case or federal authority. Even should this court decide to go beyond the four corners of the opinion and look to the underlying cases, yes, Roviaro is mentioned. However, in no way is it mentioned as being compelling or binding upon the Colorado Supreme Court. In fact, the particular rules of law which govern disclosure in Colorado, number one, that there be a good faith basis in fact to question the accuracy of the affidavit, and number two, that a defendant must show that there's a reasonable basis in fact to believe either one, the informant doesn't exist, or two, if he does exist, he did not relate to the police officer what's contained in the affidavit, are unique creations of Colorado law. When the Colorado Supreme Court made these specific rules, they did not cite any federal authority at all. In fact, they didn't even cite the authority from any other jurisdiction. This is the creation of Colorado law, pure and simple. And Roviaro is mentioned, but there is nothing in the opinion that states, even explicitly or implicitly, that we are compelled to follow Roviaro. We are required to follow Roviaro. In fact, the model penal codes also mentioned. Professor Lefebvre's treatise on search and seizure is mentioned. Neither of them are mentioned in any kind of binding way, but merely for guidance. And when the decision is actually made, it's, again, a unique creation of Colorado law. And yes, there is no plain statement pursuant to Michigan v. Long. And as the questions clearly showed, the decision in Michigan v. Long came 5 months after the decision in Nunez. But what we really have in this case is not a situation where we're arguing or where the respondent is arguing that there's an independent and adequate state ground, because that implies that there's a federal ground to begin with. And it's the respondent's position that there is no federal ground whatsoever in the instant case. It was determined entirely on state law. And that the other issues regarding preliminary threshold showing and regarding what a defendant needs to be successful in a veracity challenge were matters decided in other cases. And as a matter of fact, in the Daly case, what the Colorado Supreme Court said about veracity challenges is not only consistent with Franks, but they stated our rule was the same prior to Franks. And in fact, in the appendix to the Franks decision, it lists Colorado as one of the states that allows a veracity challenge based upon the exact same showing that came down in Franks v. Delaware, prior to your decision.
Do you think Roe v. Arro is itself a decision which construes the federal Constitution?
No, Roe v. Arro is this court, as I understand it, acting in supervisory capacity, dealing with an evidentiary matter based upon federal common law.
But McRae, of course, would be construing the Constitution.
Absolutely. And, in fact, it was McRae that established that Roe v. Arro, established clearly that Roe v. Arro was not constitutional litigation or adjudication, but was rather this court acting in its supervisory capacity. And there is nothing inconsistent in McRae from what Colorado has done. In fact, I think the McRae decision is the most supportive of the authority and right of the Colorado Supreme Court to create evidentiary rules regarding the common law informer's privilege as it sees fit, just the way it can create privileges with respect to the husband and wife privilege.
Well, it can be more favorable to the defendant, criminal defendant in that area. It can't be less favorable. Isn't that what it boils down to?
The only way, in my opinion, that the United States Constitution would get involved in this question would be if the Colorado Supreme Court interpreted the common law informer's privilege in such a way that it infringed upon defendants' rights. For example, if it said a defendant may never get disclosure for trial or at a suppression hearing, that would run afoul of the 14th Amendment. But if Colorado is going to come up with a liberal interpretation, certainly since there is no constitutional principle or no constitutional right enjoyed by a law enforcement agent or by the informant to not have the identity disclosed, I don't believe that emanates from any constitutional provision, but rather from the common law. Given that fact, as long as the Colorado Supreme Court does not run afoul of another constitutional provision by cutting off some of a defendant's other rights, I don't believe it's a constitutional issue at all. And it's not even a federal issue, which we've been arguing throughout these proceedings. It's purely a matter of state concern. And again, as Justice Marshall inquired, Colorado has not adopted any kind of per se rule that any time there's a informant in an affidavit, a defendant is entitled to disclosure. In fact, Colorado, in its decisions, has clearly stated it supports the common law informer's privilege. It gives it a great deal of weight. And in reaction to that, in the instant case, it states that a defendant must make a preliminary showing. There's a mandatory showing a defendant must make before he can gain disclosure. And secondly, there's another safeguard built in, and that's the in-camera hearing, which in this case was not requested by the prosecution, but in other cases has been requested and has been granted, and is a way to actually balance this very difficult problem between keeping the information.
Of course, if you're right, whether this is quite a sensible opinion of the Supreme Court, it doesn't make it. We can think they're bananas if we want to, but if it's the state ground, it's none of our business.
That's true. I was hoping to convey the opinion that they weren't bananas, but that's absolutely correct. In conclusion, respondents would argue that the writ that's previously been granted in this case should be dismissed as being improvidently granted, or at a minimum, the decision of the Colorado Supreme Court should be affirmed.
Anything further, Mr. Bernard?
Just one, Mr. Chief Justice, just one point. The issue on disclosure was argued below, and the record will bear that out. But I think that there is some confusion here between what Mr. Stern says and what I say. Mr. Stern suggests that this is merely a discovery issue. I submit that it is not a discovery issue. The issue here is the use of disclosure in a veracity hearing, which triggers constitutional issues of probable cause and police misconduct. It is not a question of disclosure for trial, at which an accused may want to have someone who witnessed the crime present to testify, but it is an issue of the warrant process. And the warrant process is part and parcel of this court's determination. In Daly, the case upon which the Colorado Supreme Court relied, when that court discussed disclosure, it referred to the Fourth Amendment, to Franks versus Delaware, to the sanctions that should fall under Franks versus Delaware and under the Fourth Amendment, and in no place did it refer to any bit of Colorado Constitution. It talked about McRae. It talked about Roe v. Arro. It talked about Franks.
May I interrupt you right there? On the reference to Robiaro, is it the state's position that that was a constitutional case?
No. However, in
and
this...
And what is the relevance of the Colorado Supreme Court's reference to Robiaro?
Robiaro talks about the privilege in a general sense. In Robiaro, that was not in this context. It was a situation where the accused saw the crime, the act upon which the charge was based. And that was the focus of this court's concern in Robiaro. It was a due process concern.
Doesn't the citation of Robiaro, which is a non-constitutional case, by the Colorado Supreme Court suggest that they thought they had a non-constitutional issue before them?
I don't think it's that clear, Your Honor. I submit that...
To the extent that Robiaro sheds any light on the matter, it would point in that direction.
Well, there was also the reference to Franks versus Delaware, which is obviously a constitutional issue.
Yes, but in these earlier, the earlier Colorado cases did precede Franks against Delaware, didn't they?
Yes, they did.
Yeah.
And the issue, as far as Robiaro was concerned, is that in Robiaro, the court was talking about the existence of an informer privilege. In McRae, it talked about the disclosure of informants when the issue was not whether the informant perceived the crime upon which the charge was based. And finally, we have now the melding of McRae and Franks presented in this case.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next.